From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Yesterday, Democrats in the U.S. Senate blocked, at least temporarily, one of President Obama's biggest second-term agenda items, a giant trade deal with a dozen Pacific nations, and maybe one day more. The TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, defenders say, will help secure American influence in Asia, lower consumer costs, and create jobs in America. Opponents, many of them in the president's own party, say it will kill jobs and erode American sovereignty. This hour on Point, the tough politics and economics of President Obama's trade push. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Do you support the TPP? Why? Why not? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me first today from Washington is Manu Raju, senior congressional correspondent for Politico. He was talking to senators after the vote yesterday and is with us now. Manu, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
What happened here? They went for a cloture vote. They couldn't get the votes. The Democrats made the difference. Tell us exactly what happened yesterday.
It was a pretty remarkable scene. I mean, you've seen the Senate Democratic Caucus first time really rebel against a key aspect of President Obama's domestic agenda. Yesterday was sort of a drama-filled day because we didn't really know what the outcome would be at the beginning of the day. There was a group of pro-trade Democrats who were debating whether or not to give the president consent on proceeding towards a debate over this fast-track authority. Now, remember, the debate yesterday was not about voting on the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, necessarily. It was about this fast-track authority, which is an essential first step that Congress must make before enacting that, moving towards this TPP agreement.
And that's because they're in the final stages of negotiation. They've got all these countries involved, and they won't trust that it will go ahead smoothly if it's open to all kinds of amendments forever. They want an up or down fast vote once they get there.
Correct. That's exactly what they were debating yesterday. Now, these pro-trade Democrats were under a lot of pressure from their own Senate Democratic Caucus, which by and large opposes this trade deal because of their fears that this would cost American jobs. They debated for a long time internally about whether or not to give the president consent to go forward. But at the end of the day, what the key player in this was Ron Wyden, who's the Oregon Democrat, who's the ranking member on the Senate Finance Committee, convened a meeting of about 14 Senate Democrats, and they came out and said that they were not going to move forward on this bill until Republicans consented on moving forward with more trade enforcement provisions, namely a big measure dealing with customs enforcement. They wanted this packaged together with trade adjustment assistance legislation, which essentially would provide money to help train displaced workers, as well as another dealing with Africa. An Africa trade measure as well. They wanted this all packaged together in one large bill that would be added to this fast-track authority before they would consent. And the Republicans opposed it, and Democrats were at loggerheads with the GOP and the White House, and they ultimately decided to block this legislation from moving forward, leaving its future in an uncertain path.
So here we are. They're not up on the fast track. Mitch McConnell had a choice. He could have let some of these extra provisions in here. He decided not to do that. Why is that? Did he think they were materially, bad for trade, bad for the economy? Or is
all
this a
above
political gamesmanship? What's happening?
Yeah, I think it's all of the above. You know, on the merits of it, there's one specific provision that the pro-trade forces view as a poison pill. It's an anti-currency manipulation language that Democrats have been pushing that they added to this customs enforcement bill. And what that provision would do is that it would allow companies in the United States who feel that who argue that other companies, their rival companies, are benefiting from countries that are allegedly undervaluing their currency to petition the United States government to impose tariffs on those companies.
And they've pointed in the past at Japan, at South Korea, some
correct
say China right now.
Yeah, and Japan is, of course, a key member of this agreement, and they are strongly opposed to any sort of currency manipulation language, and so is the White House, and so is the Treasury Department. They're fighting this very hard, and they say this could undermine the entire TPP. So they want this out of the deal. Late last night, Senate Democrats proposed they would take out that currency language, and they would actually allow that to move separately, as long as the Republicans consented to a number of their other demands on labor enforcement and other issues that are part of their laundry list of demands. They said they would go along if they to separate this out. Whether Republicans accept that right now remains to be seen, because they do have some other concerns with the Democratic demands they're negotiating right now as we speak.
So that's a path that might lead to the revival of the TPP and the fast-track option after the vote. There were pretty tough words from both sides. Here was Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell saying the no vote his word was shocking.
Well, Mr. President, what we just saw here is pretty shocking. There are always limits to what can be accomplished when the American people choose divided government. But of course, it doesn't mean Washington shouldn't work toward bipartisan solutions that make sense for our country. Trade offers a perfect opportunity to do just that.
Harry Reid, used to be majority leader, came back hard on that, saying it was all Mitch McConnell's fault.
My friend, the majority leader, has one person to blame for our not being on the floor now debating this important piece of legislation. That person is the majority leader. Next time he looks in the mirror, he can understand who is responsible for not having a debate, as he said, with robust amendments. It's him.
And at the White House, snafus. Here's Josh Earnest, the White House press secretary.
It is not unprecedented, to say the least, for the United States Senate to encounter procedural snafus.
Manu Raju, please stand by with Politico, who's been covering all this in Washington. I want to bring a couple more voices in right here, if I may. From Washington, Robert Scott joins us. He's director of trade and manufacturing policy research at the Economic Policy Institute, liberal-leaning think tank there. Robert Scott, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And from the Peterson Institute, a free market think tank in Washington, senior fellow Gary Huffbauer joins us, former deputy assistant secretary for international trade and investment policy at the U.S. Treasury. Gary Huffbauer, thank you for being here today.
Thank you, Tom.
Robert, first to you. What do you make of what happened in the Senate yesterday and essentially the Democrats' rebellion against the president's own push?
Well, I think that Democrats are tired of approving more of the same old deals that have led to growing trade deficits, to job losses, and to, most importantly, to downward pressure on the wages of working Americans. And I think it's all come down to a debate about over the terms of this agreement. And I think that the Democrats are saying, in particular, that we can't just do this more of the same old that we've been doing for 20 years that hasn't worked.
But the argument from the White House is that this is not the same old, that there are labor standards in here, there are environmental protections in here, there are provisions in here for handling patent and copyright law that should favor the United States over the long term.
Well, unfortunately, I think what that claim comes down to is trust me, we haven't seen the text of the agreement. The president and his aides refused to release the text. And I think there are serious questions about whether this agreement even lives up to the standards that were set a few years ago in what's known as the May 10th agreement over issues like labor and environmental standards. But beyond that, there is the issue which you mentioned at the outset, which is currency manipulation, which has not been dealt yet within trade agreements, and I think it's the key question here in this trade agreement. Currency manipulation allows countries to undervalue their currency and give them a subsidy on everything they export. It affects everything they trade and everything we export, and it's probably the most important cause of our trade deficits and the job losses that you've been talking about.
I want to come back to that.
We're not dealing with that yet.
Gary Huffbauer, I'll come to you, but Manu, can we nail down this business of whether or not people can read this? Now, not everybody can read it, but when people say we can't read it, can't senators go and read it right now?
Yes, they can.
Absolutely. This claim is complete baloney. It's a negotiation. As long as the negotiation is going on, somebody has to give, and it's very hard to give if you're reading it in real time, if there's a camera in the room. The senators don't have a camera in the room when they're negotiating between themselves. But the senators can read the text as it comes out, as can congressmen. They can't take it out and publish it. But this is a complete red herring that has been introduced.
Gary, stand by. Manu, can you explain to us exactly, because we've heard this again and again, it's secret, it's being done in the dark, and yet, as far as I understand, and Gary's saying just now, senators can in fact go and read it when they please.
Yeah, the USTR, the trade representative that's negotiating this agreement, they have made this available for senators to look at since 2012. But the caveat being that there are a lot of restrictions on what they can see, whether they can take notes, whether they can actually bring staff members in, whether they can leave with those notes, but the USTR has tried very hard to make it available for members of Congress, actually bringing it to the Capitol building so members can access it in classified settings. And the reason why they say this is classified is because while they're negotiating this agreement with the different countries, they don't want to say, you know, while they're negotiating something with Japan, they don't want that to undermine separate discussions that they're having with Malaysia, for instance. They argue that these things need to be kept in secret because that's the way negotiations happen.
But I want to clarify one thing. You said there are some restrictions on what they can see. So can they read the deal or not?
They can read the deal, but they can't take pictures of it. They can't take notes and leave with those
notes.
But
no restrictions on what they can see, or are there?
You know, this is a point of contention. It's hard for us to know exactly from the outside because we can't see it. The public can't see it. But these members, the administration says that the members can, in fact, see it in these classified settings.
It doesn't sound as quite as secret as we've been told. We'll look at that and much more. The TPP hanging, maybe not fair to say by a thread. It could be revived here, but Democrats rebelling yesterday against their own president and providing the key votes that have so far kept it up off the fast track rails. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this time about the president's big Pacific trade deal in kind of a mess now, in pretty big trouble, at least for the moment, on Capitol Hill. The president's party in the Senate saying no to the TPP as presented, to the path forward presented by the White House. Manu Raju is with us from Politico, senior congressional correspondent. They're all over the machinations on Capitol Hill yesterday. Robert Scott is with us, director of trade and manufacturing policy research at the Economic Policy Institute. And Gary Huffbauer is here, senior fellow with the Peterson Institute for International Economics. There have been some pretty big grenades thrown at this for a while now. On NPR's Morning Edition on Tuesday, here was Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren. She's emerged as a big opponent of the TPP.
The first is that the president is asking us to vote to grease the skids on a trade deal that has largely been negotiated, but that is still held in secret. The second is that we know that corporations under this deal are going to get to sue countries for regulations they don't like, and that the decisions are not going to be made by courts. They're going to be made by private lawyers.
Elizabeth Warren, the president, saying it's all hypothetical. She's absolutely wrong. Not all Democrats have been so fiercely opposed in tone. Ron Wyden, Democrat of Oregon, who upped Kraft, the bill that was in front of the Senate yesterday, explains here why this is after the vote, but why he had supported the trade deal but didn't support what was on the table yesterday, as he couldn't get all of those amendments and surrounding provisions included.
Together, these bills would form a legislative package that throws out the 1990s NAFTA playbook on trade. It's an opportunity to enact fresh, middle-class trade policies that will create high-skill, high-wage jobs in Oregon and across our land. That opportunity is lost if this package of four bills gets winnowed down to two.
Four bills that Mitch McConnell, Republican majority leader, was not willing to throw into the mix yesterday, and down it went without Democratic support. Republicans sort of torn on this, whether to maybe celebrate the president's discomfort or bemoan the fact that what they've also supported, big trade deal, is not moving forward yesterday. Here was Senator John Thune, South Dakota.
essentially what the Democrats are doing today by trying to block us from even getting on this legislation is throwing their own president under the bus.
We've got a lot of questions from our listeners. Robert in Bowling Green, Kentucky. Thank you very much for calling. Robert, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom.
Yeah.
I have a very simple question. I've been trying to follow this story, and all I'm hearing about is regulations and concessions. I was hoping that maybe you, your panelists, could just give me a simple answer as to the pro or the con of this deal.
You know, I guess that all depends who you're going to ask, but we'll try and do that for you, Robert. Manu, I'm going to start with you. If you look at the pros and cons of the TPP, and keep it simple for Robert and Bowling Green, how would you take that on?
Well, again, it certainly depends on who you ask. The proponents of this measure would say that this would increase American exports affecting economies around the world. This is such a sweeping agreement. This will be the largest trade agreement in history, affecting about 40% of the world economy. And clearly, the argument among the proponents is that this would help boost American exports and revive sectors of the economy that have been hurt by trade agreements in the past by making certain changes that would learning from some of the past mistakes and trade deals and such. And the opponents would say that this is something that would actually lead to the outsourcing of American jobs. And that's what really the dividing line comes down to. When we get into the fine print of the agreement, again, that becomes a little bit harder to nail down exactly the different specifics of these discussions because, as we mentioned earlier, those specifics are still are not being made public while this is being negotiated.
A dozen nations all around the Pacific, including North America, South America, East Asia, Southeast Asia. China's not in this one. The president has warned that if we don't do this, China will set down the rules. He has his defense secretary, Ash Carter, out saying if we want influence in the world and the Pacific, we've got to have this deal, and maybe more countries would join it as it goes forward. Robert Scott, if I put Robert's question to you from Bowling Green, and give us both sides in your view, if you would be good enough, pro and con on TPP.
Well, I think what the question comes down to is really winners and losers. I think on the pro side, one can make the argument that this is going to do things like greatly enhance intellectual property rights enforcement. That's going to help people who export pharmaceuticals, people who make software and applications for telephones, movie producers. Those are going to be the winners from this agreement.
That sounds generally good for the United States, isn't it?
That sounds great for the United States, but then think about who's going to be the losers. The losers are going to be people who are going to be competing and losing jobs to that or outsourcing of production. So we're going to import more labor-intensive goods. We're going to export capital and intellectual property. That's going to shift the demand for workers. It's going to bid up the demand for workers with college degrees. It's going to create excess supplies of workers without college degrees. Well, workers without college degrees still make up 70% of the labor force. Their wages are going to be driven down and driven down a lot. In fact, the decline in their wages will exceed any gains that we get from trade. So, yes, they're going to be winners. It will be mostly people who are college educated, people who own stock in software companies and pharmaceuticals and executives of those companies. So this agreement is really about redistribution, about changing the way America works.
Now, I'll bring this to you, Gary, but let me stick with you for a second, Robert. I mean, because what we've been told is that we are in a global market, whether we have these deals or not, and that our only choice is to compete, is to climb up the ladder of skills and training and education. You seem to be giving up on that here, saying, no, we can't all climb up there. So, but what about the global market? Isn't it there whether or not we sign this deal?
No question. We have to embrace that market, but we have to decide on what terms we're going to engage it. We are still the largest market in the world for imports and exports, and we have to use that leverage. What this deal would do is use that leverage to increase the monopoly that intellectual property rights holders have on copyrights. Well, that's a choice. That's not about trade. That's about rules governing investment. We could instead use this agreement, for example, to stop currency manipulation. Unfair trade. That would help expand exports of manufactured goods, which would put more people without college degrees back to work. It would build the demand for those workers and raise their wages.
So do we actually have the leverage have to do that, or does the whole deal just fall apart if that's what the U.S. insists on? Do we really have that power now in 2015?
I think we do have that power, and I'm not alone. There are many other economists who called for including currency in this agreement. And I think the reason is you'll get protestation from countries like China and Singapore and Malaysia, who are currency manipulators. But at the end of the day, what they really want is access to our market. You don't really know what countries will accept until you put the issues on the table. We haven't put this issue on the table. Issues were put on the table late, for example, in the last big round of multinational trade negotiations, the so-called Uruguay round, it took place in the early 1990s. That's where we created the World Trade Organization. Big institution. Came in at the 11th hour. The U.S. raised it, and it was accepted. So we can make big changes because we have the leverage in these negotiations.
Gary Huff, let me put the same simple question to you. How do you see the pros and the cons of the TPP?
Trying to keep it simple, the first pro is this means not more jobs, but better jobs for Americans. The kinds of things we export are really highly paid types of jobs, Caterpillar, Boeing, General Electric, and so forth. That's technical progress. Just like to take the flip side of that, when the ATM was invented, that put a lot of tellers out of work. Mm-hmm. When Bill Gates came out with Windows, that put a lot of secretaries out of work. Were those bad things? No, those were good things because we climbed up the ladder, to use the language that you put into the conversation, Tom.
But what if everybody isn't climbing the ladder? You know that the median wages have not climbed for a long time. We've had big unemployment and underemployment. Maybe this is a moment where you've got some Democrats saying, this just isn't working overall. You say not more jobs, but better jobs. Some people might just want more jobs.
Well, the unemployment rate recently dropped down to 5.4%. That isn't good enough, but it's in the right direction. More to your point, you are quite right. Median wages have been flat or just barely increased for quite a long period of time. Is globalization, is trade the reason? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. The reason is that we have a lot of high technology brought to us by people like Stephen Jobs and Bill Gates and Larry Ellison and a lot of these geniuses. And that has cut in to demand for lower-skilled workers right across the economy. That's the big reason. Contrary to what Robert Scott said, trade is not the reason. It does not put downward wage pressure on the U.S. economy.
If the steel is made in China instead of in the U.S., if the wage standard is established in Vietnam instead of Oklahoma, why isn't that downward pressure?
Because we export things that China does not make. We export, for example, healthcare services on quite a big scale. We export educational services, all those foreign students coming to Yale and UCLA and so forth, which lead to well-paid jobs in the university systems. So you're looking at just one side of it, and I wanted to go on and agree with Robert on the con side.
Okay.
It is true that there are losers, and you can't say that there aren't losers, but in terms of the U.S. economy, the winnings way, way outweigh the losings by about 20 to 1. So he's got the arithmetic completely wrong on that. But the winnings are very widely distributed. You see them every time you go to Target or Walmart, every time a more productive firm comes up because it's competing with imports. Those are the winnings, but they're very widely distributed. The losers, you mentioned steel. You could mention textiles. You could mention apparel. You could mention furniture. Yes, the workers there do lose, and it's very important, as Senator Wyden has said, that we have programs that deal much more effectively than the existing programs with the losers, with new training, greater education, mobility to places where there are jobs, that whole package.
It is sensitive. Here was Dick Durbin, Senator Democrat from Illinois, talking right down this line about why trade deals have become so sensitive. People look at these with a real fine-tooth comb these days. Here's Durbin.
Trade is a controversial issue. It's important to America's economy, but when you take it home and you meet with your people you represent, there are strong mixed feelings about trade. Some who work for Caterpillar Tractor Company in Illinois want to promote trade, sell more of those big yellow tractors. But many look at trade and say, I could be a casualty. I could be a victim. They can ship my job overseas, Senator. So what are you going to do to make sure I'm protected?
Dick Durbin. So how do we craft this? Let's get our listeners in here. Latham is calling from Detroit. Latham, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. I'm a former GM auto worker.
Okay.
And I worked for GM for 44 years all over the world. Mm-hmm. And I started as a tradesman, a skilled tradesman in the automobile industry. Those jobs that I helped support overseas actually were sent there from General Motors, from automobile industry. They're from the auto industry.
Yes.
That I grew up in. And that industry is being, in my mind, will not be hurt, helped by the TPP. The skilled trades people that I am a part of, that group, they will be decimated. In the 70s and 80s, we shipped tons of jobs overseas. They thought, oh, you will do so much better by sending them to Japan and China. We had to come back and repair a lot of those tools. That type of trade is something we don't need.
So what should we do, Latham? Just put up walls to keep to keep those jobs here? Say we don't want your cars, Japan? Will that work?
Skilled trade and fair trade. I don't mind being competing against Japanese, Chinese, or whoever in fair trade. The problem is it isn't fair. They're undercutting us in not only in currency, but they undercut us in, you talk about prices, the wages of when I was in GM as a skilled tradesman, I was making like $29 an hour. Okay, guess what? That is not going to happen anymore. The guys are being forced, okay, and with a two-tier pay system, the money is going down. So the people who actually are in skilled trades now will be making less than they were making before. And who buys U.S. cars? General Motors and Ford and Chrysler employees. Their wages will be reduced. A two-tier system, a $12 an hour system or $15 an hour system, basically you can't buy an automobile today that's made in the United States.
New guys coming in and making just that, not the 29 you made. Latham, I appreciate your call. Manu, you hear right there the skepticism. Hard, I don't know, won or learned over many years here. Some Americans just not buying the trade argument, Manu.
Yeah, it's a very emotional issue.
That's more than emotion. That's real wages.
That
he made 29, real. They make 12. That's
make difference. And that is what is making it so hard, particularly for Democrats. I think on the auto side, what the proponents on Capitol Hill are pushing to alleviate those concerns is exactly that currency manipulation language. Folks who represent the auto industry in the Senate are aggressively pushing for that anti-currency manipulation language because of fears within the auto industry, among the labor unions that represent the auto workers, that it would lead to the export of jobs, particularly in competition with Japan. Folks, people like Debbie Stabenow, who's a Michigan Democrat, is taking the lead on this issue with Rob Portman, who's an Ohio Republican, who also represents a state that has been impacted by trade. Clearly, this is an issue that people on Capitol Hill are hearing very loudly from their constituents.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at WBUR.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the president's big Pacific trade deal. In big trouble on Capitol Hill right now, the president's party, Democrats in the Senate, saying no to the TPP so far as presented, the path forward that the White House has pushed here. The negotiations are not finished, that is, internationally, or maybe even in Washington. Talk of the president summoning key Democrats in today to talk about possible new strategies. Democrats maybe agreeing to drop their insistence on currency protection provisions here. But the fate of this big package up in the air as we speak here right now. Manu Raju covers Congress for Politico, senior congressional correspondent there, and he's with us from Washington. Robert Scott is here from the Economic Policy Institute. Gary Huffbauer with the Peterson Institute for International Economics, free market think tank in Washington. Yesterday, after the vote, Orrin Hatch, Republican, Utah, chair of the Senate Finance Committee, said that sacrificing the TPP to help fix international currency manipulation was just not worth it. We could lose the whole deal.
There's a lot of people who would like to see something done on currency, but not to destroy the TPA bill. Or should I say, all of the negotiations that this administration has been conducting with regard to TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership of 11 nations, including Japan, which has always been difficult to get to the table.
Hard to herd all these cats to the table, Senator Hatch saying there. But on Face the Nation on Sunday on CBS, you had Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, Democratic candidate for president now, saying, forget the whole thing. TPP will hurt American workers.
I am strongly opposed to that trade agreement because I think it follows in the footsteps of other disastrous trade agreements, which have cost us millions of jobs.
Let's go to our listeners, Aaron in Omaha, Nebraska. Aaron, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm calling really about a rarely talked about part of this proposed agreement, and that's the investor-state dispute settlement where corporations can sue our government for monetary damages for violating any trade agreements that hurt the company's expected future profits.
Mm-hmm.
I think I see that as fundamentally undermining the sovereignty of the United States government. And this means not only that foreign corporations can sue our government, but that our own corporations can say, well, because you have regulated our industry so much here in the United States, you've impacted our expected future profits, and we believe that you should either get rid of those regulations for clean water or clean air, or you need to pay us monetary damages. I can't believe more people aren't talking about this. However, I think one of the reasons people aren't talking about it is because of something that I feel one of your guests, Gary, earlier, just out and out told at best a half-truth about, and that is the fact that this is a secret deal. This is a secret deal, despite what he says. As of right now, this is yesterday, as of yesterday, members of Congress can only see the text of the TPP in a secure room. And in that secure room, they're not able to bring their staffers, they're not allowed to take notes, and they're not even allowed to talk about the specifics in public. This makes it a secret agreement, right? Why does the president want to do this? Because he wants to make it filibuster-proof first, then he can pretend transparency later. But the fact that we're going to give up essential sovereignty of our government, I think, is the biggest poison pill. It's the thing that ought to kill this agreement.
Aaron, let us pick up that issue. Manu, I'll bring it first to you. Is it fair to describe this as a sacrifice of sovereignty, this investor-state dispute settlement?
That's actually the key flashpoint between the progressives in the Senate Democratic Caucus, like Elizabeth Warren and President Obama right now. This has been the central dispute. Basically, what that system is designed to do is to create a neutral arbitration mechanism, creating a stable sort of legal environment and trying to ensure that investments in countries where investors might fear unfair treatment, that those disputes are dealt with on a level playing field.
But to Aaron's point, that would not be the U.S. government deciding that. That would be arbitrators or, as Elizabeth Warren puts it, you know, private lawyers.
Yeah, and that is what the critics say, that this could undermine public interest regulation. sanctions, including Dodd-Frank, the financial reform law that the folks in the Warren wing of the party have pushed very hard to do. But the president just absolutely rejects that argument. He said that it is a complete misinterpretation of exactly how that would be implemented, and that is not exactly what's happening here. And that is an essence of the dispute between the two parties right now. While it's certainly one that has not generated most of the headlines, is part that's bubbling right underneath.
Here's the president. This was Saturday, talking with Matt Bayh, Yahoo News, rejecting Senator Warren's concern on exactly this point, among other things, Warren saying that it could let foreign corporations undermine rules, U.S. rules, like Dodd-Frank. Here's the president.
There is no evidence that this could ever be used in this way. This is pure speculation. She and I both taught law school, and you know, one of the things you do as a law professor is you spin out hypotheticals. And this is all hypothetical, speculative.
Hypothetical, speculative. Gary Huffbauer, loss of sovereignty here?
I'm going to give you, Tom, a little bit of a complicated argument. Every time we have a treaty with another country or an agreement, we lose a little bit of sovereignty. NATO, any agreement with Canada, and we have hundreds of them with Canada and Mexico and all our partners. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's the business of countries agreeing with each other on issues. So, yes, it does mean that certain kinds of disputes will be treated in a different way than they otherwise would have been. Arbitration is nothing new to the American system. We have lots of arbitrations between firms, between individuals, and so forth. So there's nothing novel there.
But the fear is that it will lash the United States into old policies that some want to move away from. They may want better labor standards. They may want tougher. May want tougher financial regulations.
Yes. Well, I was going to come to that, Tom.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Mm-hmm. If you actually read these investor-state dispute settlement provisions, which have been written out more than 2,000 times, and the language is very similar from one case to another, where when the U.S. enters into these kinds of agreements, they accept, in other words, it's not a proper subject of a dispute to question environmental regulations, which are proper environmental regulations, health regulations, safety, including Dodd-Frank. So the president is absolutely right on this. Of course, you can sue anything. You can sue Tom Ashbrook for defamation with no basis whatsoever. So somebody might waste money bringing a case. 13 cases under ISDS have been brought against the United States. The United States has lost none of them. Why? Because the ISDS provisions, the substantive provisions, closely reflect U.S. law with respect to Fifth Amendment rights, how we deal with private property and so forth. And we're exporting those ideas to the rest of the world. So kind of what's wrong there? I find this a flash in the pan, which has been completely misstated. And I do want to correct one point that the caller said. Mm-hmm. This does not these arbitration systems are not open to U.S. corporations. They're open to foreign investors in the United States or U.S. investors abroad because of the fear that local courts might be biased in favor of, you know, their own firms.
Robert Scott, these provisions of ISDS, Investor State Dispute Settlement, Gary Huffbauer says, look, all treaties entail some sacrifice of sovereignty. No big deal here. This is business as usual.
Well, business as usual changed in 1993 when we signed the North American Free Trade Agreement. Mm-hmm. We included an ISDS, or Investor State Dispute mm-hmm. Settlement Mechanism there, included the words, any kind of move, it would be, quote, tantamount to expropriation, unquote. And that changed the ground fundamentally. And I can give you three specific examples of when these cases have been used to change fundamental regulations. In Egypt, a minimum wage law was challenged in an ISDS setting by a European company, and they were hit with a heavy fine. And put, you know, that's how it works. They put in place fines, and the countries are forced to relent. This is exactly what happened in Germany. They had a an environmental regulation that they tried to promulgate, and they were hit with another heavy fine under another trade investment agreement. In two other countries, Uruguay and Australia, they tried to tighten up anti-smoking regulations. They were hit with major fines in these ISDS cases. So foreign corporations can sue the U.S. A U.S. corporation can set up a subsidiary in Bermuda or any foreign country. They can invert themselves, and they can sue the U.S. government as well. And that is the threat from this agreement. There's no reason to create these special protections for investors only. They should have to do the same thing that, for example, people complaining about labor rights have to do. Labor unions and other public advocates have to go to the U.S. government. The government has to pursue their claim through these international dispute mechanisms. Why are we singling out investors here for special protection? That's the question.
There's the range of views right there. Holly in Austin, Texas. Holly, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. My concerns lie in what's going to happen to the standard of consumer products.
Okay.
We've been pushing, for example, for GMO labeling of food. China's standards are much lower than the U.S.'s, and food in particularly meat production as well as just consumer products. So my concern is that when you're talking about these investors' provision is that, for example, their corporations can say that, or the investors can say that GMO labeling hurts their business, and so they're not going to do it.
Holly, let us pick it up. Manu Raju, Holly's particularly concerned about consumer product standards there. Now, to be clear, China, not in the TPP, but it does deal with all kinds of standards. Is that a place where if she's shopping at Target or Walmart or elsewhere where there are a lot of imported goods, she should be worried about this trade deal undercutting the quality of those products or supporting consumer product quality standards, Manu?
You know, that's exactly the debate that's happening right now. I'm not in a position to say one way or another while this negotiation is still happening exactly how this would affect what's happening, the products that you'll eventually be able to purchase at Target, Walmart, et cetera. But that's clearly the essence of the debate here, isn't it? I mean, this is what the critics fear, that the products that will be imported from this country will not be subject to the same labor standards that the United States imposes. And that's one of the reasons why Democrats are pushing for this customs enforcement package that's part of to add that to the fast track trade authority provision that's hanging in the balance in the Senate right now. So,
but you've got people saying the opposite here. I mean, I'm looking at the New York Times editorial on this, and they're saying this deal would actually get countries to adopt similar, more U.S. style regulations on labor, on environmental protection, on foreign investors and patent copyright law.
And Tom, that is exactly the White House's argument, too, that it would raise those standards. And that's why they say that this would be the most, they say, quote, progressive trade agreement in history, because they believe that it would raise those standards in the foreign countries to what the United States has on their consumer products.
Let's talk political nitty gritty here. I mean, there's talk that there were eight Senate Democrats who seemed to be on board with the president, and all but one of them in Delaware bailed yesterday. Do you see them being herded back into line here? Might there be some agreement being hammered out even as we speak to get this thing going again, Manu?
Yeah, I do. I feel pretty confident that it's going to get out of the Senate. I think that they are going to get some sort of accommodation, because when we look at the dispute right now among the pro-trade Democrats and the Republicans in the White House, it's largely a procedural dispute. And a lot of those procedural disputes can get sorted out if there's reached some sort of accommodation. I'm not sure if this happens this month, and the longer this drags on, the fear is that it could undermine the larger TPP negotiations if Congress does not act swiftly. But I should caution, even if this gets out of the Senate, the chances in the House are even grimmer, actually. There are lots of Democrats, most Democrats there oppose moving forward on the fast-track trade authority, which is essential to the TPP. There are a fair amount of Republicans, particularly Tea Party Republicans, who oppose giving the president this kind of blanket authority. So you're going to see even if the president is able to get those 8 to 10 pro-Tate Senate Democrats on his side, it's no slam dunk in getting this onto his desk at the end of the day.
Robert Scott, the president says if we don't have fast track, the White House says it's tantamount to losing the deal because there's no way to hold it together without, you know, sort of getting it up on this fast up or down vote. If you get everybody in there making amendments and wanting to make changes, our negotiating partners will balk and it will all fall apart. Do you agree?
Well, I think that's an extreme statement. Sure, you can create a straw man that makes it look impossible to create the deal.
It's been the way for every other trade agreement. It's not as if it hasn't been the way before.
That's not true. I think Congress first yielded this authority to the president in 1974. We've been doing trade deals for hundreds of years. I think what's central here is a question of what are going to be the terms of engagement? What rules are we going to demand that guarantee the working Americans are going to see real benefits from this agreement? And we could put those conditions in a trade promotion authority. So the question is not do we have trade promotion authority or not. The question is what are going to be the negotiating objectives? What is going to be required? What are going to be required elements in this agreement?
Gary, we've just got half a minute here. If we don't do the deal, what's the cost to the American economy, the American people as you see it?
Well, it's a terrific cost because this is a gateway deal not only to these countries, which are about 30-40% of the world economy, but it's a gateway to the transatlantic trade and investment partnership. That's Europe and the United States. It's a gateway to doing more constructive bargains in the World Trade Organization. And it's the gateway to U.S. leadership in the world economic system. We don't do this deal, we lose it all.
Robert Scott, you think it'll be stopped? You think it'll be dramatically changed?
I think at the minimum it's going to be dramatically changed.
And keeping all those trade partners at the table?
I think there's no question that all of those partners want access to the U.S. market. At the end of the day, they will be there when the deal is being closed.
Well, you've got the terms of the debate right here, and we're grateful to all three of you for helping us get that. Robert Scott at the Economic Policy Institute, thank you very much for joining us today, Robert.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Gary Huffbauer, Peterson Institute, thank you, Gary, for being here today.
Thanks, Tom.
And Manu Raju, Senior Congressional Correspondent for Politico, thank you so much for your insights, Manu.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks for joining us, listeners. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.